dangerous, twisted mystery podcast. Less cozy, more ugly. Warping listeners' minds since 2022. Music by Dangerous. Narrated by Twisted. Chapter 53. Abduction Junction. Brent felt his senses sharpen with each angular footstep he made towards the shining jewel that was his goal. He took the stone steps three at a time, his gear silent like he was hovering in space. His team were ghosts behind him, albeit armed ghosts with a serious, solid purpose. Brent was surrounded by a jacket of anger barely kept in check, and that was why he didn't chatter. He kept his orders in tight bursts. Brent blew by the gate guards, delegated one of the agents at the rear to explain what looked like a small invasion to a couple of fat men in neon security shirts and caps. He heard the raising of voices. This was his chance to let out some of his mood. "Don't shoot the civs unless you have to," he spoke into a headset that connected everyone in his troop. There were no laughs, but a thaw of tension. The crowd was pressing for an encore. It rang through the outer halls and passages of the near-deserted outer part of the stadium. The only stragglers were the few people who'd left the venue to smoke. "What an oddity to have people leave the concert to smoke," Brent mused, giving hand signals to his team to fan out across the natural-flecked granite stone floor. Shrieks of surprise greeted the approach of the militia, but the sound melted into the evening sky, blanketed by a chanting teenage army inside the venue. Brent could see the door to the backstage at the end of the hall. Three men in neon polo shirts rose from their folding chairs, dropping stale crumbs from the ribbing of the material that betrayed their sedentary style of guarding. On cue, their radios crackled. "Send the agents through. Problem at the trailer." The security guard with the largest waist and the shortest inseam then pointed to Brent with his walkie-talkie and said, "Are you the agents?" Obviously, he was the brains of the operation. Brent ignored him and jumped the table set up to barricade the backstage door in a single fluid movement. He plunged into the dimly lit passage, seeing out of the corner of his eye a sign that read, "Restricted Area." The chanting suddenly stopped. That was a very bad sign. Moments before and farther ahead, another group was still on the move. The security team escorting Sabata and her father down the graded steps to ground level. On one side of them was a private parking area. On the other, the sound of the crowd chanting in rhythm was a booming heartbeat vibrating in the metal doors, even in the silence between the syllables. Sa-bi-ta. Sabata had heard it 1,000 times, but the wall of sound seemed to annoy her father, who wanted to be alert to any approach in the corridors. They came to an exit. The short one slammed into the wide bar with his elbow, and the door swung out to reveal a world that concertgoers seldom see. The grounds behind the venue hummed with a rumble of generators and idling diesel engines. This was where the equipment buses and dressing trailers were parked. Forget everything commonly associated with the words bus and trailer, however, when putting them together with superstar and tour. The trailers were packed tightly with luxury items, furnished in the latest chic decor. They closely resembled a compact version of a 5-star suite. Sabata's had large tinted windows for a public display of privacy, and a walk-in glass refrigerated pantry that housed 3 carefully sculpted fruit bouquets and an assortment of sushi flown in from the coast twice a day. Sabata seemed eager to get back to her refuge and lock herself in and wait. Her father kept glancing into the shadows that fell between the parked trucks. He didn't notice what the tall security guy did. He put his hand in front of Sabata protectively and hushed the group as he brought them to a full stop. A pause when he looked at the gleaming trailer, squinting seriously, like he was surveying a prizefighter lined up to separate his head from his shoulders. He shook his head and pointed to an empty chair beside the door. "Wasn't there a security guard in front when you left?" Sabata's father let his anxiety show. "I left so quickly." Sabata raised an eyebrow. "There were 2. There are always 2. The small guard sounded a little excited, like an unconcerned onlooker in a bar fight. "There aren't 2 now." He was obviously the kind of prick that thought that other people's problems were amusing. The tall one said in a quiet, ominous tone, "Someone's inside." He took charge, backing them through the door in which they'd just come. A door across the hall emptied into the front of the auditorium. The guard put the walkie-talkie to his lips and announced, "Send the agents through. Problem at the trailer." He switched frequencies in order to talk directly to the house manager. "House lights up." "We're going out through the crowd. It'll be safer there. Wear this." He pointed to the short guard. The guard pulled a bandana out of his pocket and tied it onto her head, hiding her signature long auburn hair. She acquiesced nervously, looking at the door from which they had just come, expecting it to open at any moment. She tucked the flaps of her bandana behind her ears. The arena was suddenly silent. The house lights had evidently knocked the wind out of the frenzied crowd. Finally, her mind came to the question that it should have asked at first mention. How would we be safer in the crowd? "I should have said, I'll be safer in the crowd, darling." Sabata felt a needle enter her neck, and a drug quickly spread up her innominate artery. There was barely a second of confusion before falling forward into her father's arms. The surprise on his face would quickly give way to a lifeless, fixed gaze as Feely took advantage of the defenseless man, completely unwilling to drop his daughter to raise a hand to protect himself. He slipped behind him and pummeled the base of his neck with a flashlight handle. His legs buckled, and Feely let him hit the ground after cutting in on his daughter like he was in the middle of some kind of sick dance. She fell into his arms, ending up face to face with her attacker. Sabata's lips moved, but no sound came out. Her face was chalk white, yet somehow she fought to keep the muscles of her face moving over and over, silently mouthing the message. He saw her anger and pulled her closer, whispering in her ear, "Wait till I get you home, darling." Her eyes rolled back into her head, and she went limp in his arms. "I love the way their nipples get hard just before lights out," Feely said, moving half of her weight onto Stone's shoulder. Stones glared at him with a look that said he was all business until the job was done. He had already slipped on a shirt hiding the security polo beneath, and he waited for Sabata leaning on him as Feely did the same. "The agents should be coming pretty soon," he thought, looking down the dark passage. "Let's go," he urged, pushing through the door and pulling his cargo along. The height difference and dead weight caused the three of them to sway like they were in a drunken three-legged race. The crowd was streaming down the stairs of the amphitheater. Moths flew into the bright lights and filtered down onto the crowds. Stones avoided these hot spots, like he might burn up if the white light touched him. Finding a handicapped exit tucked into the darkness to the left of the stage, they were out of the building and walking in a sea of cars in minutes. Red brake lights on station wagons filled with tweens courteously allowed them to pass. There wasn't an agent in sight, and about 100 yards in the distance, a van sat parked at the outer wing of the lot. It was far enough out that other cars weren't hemming it in, and it was just beside a small service road. They were a 5-minute stumble to complete freedom. Wilkes took the news update well. An unfamiliar voice crackled in his ear. It was disturbing in every way imaginable. "We're at the trailer. The father's out. We found 2 security guards, stripped and unconscious. Do we have containment on the crowd?" Wilkes could barely contain a thunderous, out-of-body anger. "They saw us coming. Get into the crowd. The local police are on their way. We'll have roadblocks up in 10 minutes. Legacy cut in through the radio chatter. 10 minutes will be too late. Blue gave them a plan, and he knows our playbook. You're going to have to go off the page to bring these guys down." It killed the career officer to countermand his own order, but he'd been wrong in a room when Legacy was right before. He could credit his decision almost as much to protecting his dignity as agreeing with Legacy. "Legacy's right." He knew right after he said it that Legacy could put himself in charge of any situation, as he was now in charge of this operation. The men reported to him, but Legacy was running the show. "I need sharpshooters on the high ground, and every available agent standing in the middle of every road leading from the venue. Nobody leaves." He pulled the headset microphone away from his lips, afraid he couldn't contain his frustration from erupting into a tirade that would likely include every vulgarity in the English language, interspersed with Russian and Farsi slurs he'd learned on assignment. He would say them all if he lost Sabata tonight, but not now. He let the mic spring back, realizing something about the field report. "Where is Agent Brent?" Brent took one look at the unconscious security guards and reversed course, heading back to the steps. He had sent the rest of the team ahead, but he'd known what they were going to find. The confirmation that the trailer was empty came across the radio as his feet hit the impacted dirt on the gravel parking lot. Brent ran at full speed across the maze of cars, headed for the main access road. He could see cars that were filing up the main ramp that led to the freeway. He had to get to that intersection. Each heartbeat meant another car was racing away from the venue, and any of them might contain the girl he'd come here to save. His body moved back and forth in an off-balance stride, straining for any more speed that his legs could give him. His muscles began to burn, and the pain gave him new strength. He wanted to be reminded of the consequences of his failure. His pain was the least of his problems. Legacy had listened to the mission fall apart from Tyke's living room. It was like hearing the final broadcasts from the ground reporters watching the Hindenburg, a fiery plunge with no way to intervene. The slight tilt of the unfinished floor beneath his feet did not benefit his balance either. He felt like he was on one of the center spheres of a perpetual motion machine, the type that had become so popular on executive desks. His station was unmoving, but in rhythmic disequilibrium as forces moved through him to their point of action. It was where the metronome paused outward that things actually happened. It was outside his sphere, literally. The only person he could blame was himself. He knew that if he'd been on location, been at the site, it would have been different. Blue had known the venue and had given specific instructions, the kind that Legacy was cycling through his brain to recreate. He picked up a thread. It wasn't much, but it might help. Wilkes, scan the fringe of the lots. Look for three people. They'll be headed for a van, and there might be a bike parked nearby. He relayed the instructions without question, and Legacy could tell that his well-placed words earlier had broken his leadership. Wilkes had started to question himself in the field, and once a commander starts blurring the line of command, he might as well step back entirely. It appeared as if that's what he'd done. Wilkes was now taking orders from Legacy. If Martin had stopped a minute to think about it, he would have marveled at wrestling control from one of the most accomplished, powerful men in the country. Beware if Legacy ever became a presidential advisor. He'd be running the country before the president creme fraiche was stale. I've lined up three with a limp payload between them. Parking lot P, Vector Southwest, and the overflow lot. He waited a second. When Wilkes did not reply, he added, Copy? Legacy spoke the language of authority. Mark the forearms of the men with your scope. Tell me what you see. Stones and Feely stumbled up to the van, making just enough joyful noise that the other concertgoers thought they were having a little too much fun. The truth was that Sabata was the first girl they'd dosed who displayed such an elevated heart rate. Stones checked her pulse every 20 paces, as directed by Blue. There was always a helpful spike in the beats per minute when the girls felt the needle go in, and that would help push the drug through the blood-brain barrier. In Sabata's case, she'd just come off the stage where her aerobic workout kept her at a sustained plateau. The injection circulated quickly to the brain, but a constant drum roll heartbeat had pushed the toxin deep into muscle tissue on a systemic level. Her legs were the first to start trembling, then her biceps contracted, bringing all three heads together with a thud. The last 50 feet they had to slow down to a crawl, but as Feely leaned Sabata against Stone's tree-like frame and pulled out the keys, he knew the experience would be the best that the retelling could offer. He could see them with all the guys grouped around them, jerking around to uproarious laughter. He spoke while turning the key in the lock. This'll be something to tell, won't it, Stones? He turned back and could immediately tell that something was wrong. Sabata was slumping to the ground with a spattering of blood on her cheek. Stones stood frozen. Feely took a step towards him and realized that it wasn't caution that kept him propped rigid up against the van. A sniper's bullet had come through the bottom of his jaw on angle through the back of his head. It looked like someone had pulled the plug on a bathtub and brains were draining out through the hole under the chin. If his expression said anything about his bewildered last thought, it must have been something like, "Why can't I turn my head?" There was no anger, no pain. Simply an unanswered query that never made it to his bloodied lips. Time, which had seemed to move so slowly as Feely examined his slain friend, caught up with him. Stones fell like a rag doll, all of the neural signal cut to his muscles. Feely stutter-stepped between running to the driver's seat and retrieving Sabata. He thought about driving up the compound without his prize, and then dropped to his knees, pulling at her arms and dragging her into the cargo, using a van door to protect himself. He looked out into the night sky the entire time, waiting for another raindrop to turn out the lights completely. Nothing but clear skies. He closed the siding door, and the latch caught twice. Or was that the sound of a clip being slammed into an automatic rifle? Brent kept a level gaze on Feely. He knew that a cornered animal was the easiest kind to shoot, and he had to restrain himself from letting his trigger finger find that warm, natural firing position. Feely raised his hands, a warped, manic smile coming to his quivering lips. Is there only one of you? Only one of me, Brent began slowly, but his effort to calm Feely only gave him an opening. If he could get past him, he was free. A knife flashed in Feely's hands, and with a quick motion, he drew it back to throw. Two bullets ripped into Feely, one into his upper throwing arm and the next into his chest. The sniper hadn't waited for an order. Brent waved his arms in a panic. Stop shooting! Who is shooting? It was too late. Feely was on the ground. Blood spilling front and back, soaking the clay soil beneath him. The knife dropped harmlessly from his fingers. Feely shrugged impishly as Brent approached, his face set in a childish panic. I dropped my knife. His glassy eyes fixed on Brent. You're in trouble now. You drew blood. Only Blade is allowed to draw blood. You're in trouble now. His breathing was labored. The interrogation would have to be quick. Brent pulled out his first aid kit and went through the motions of stabilizing Feely. It was only trappings. The deal had been closed with the wound gushing into his lungs. It was all a matter of watching the second hand on a clock. He spoke into his headset, giving the home base all the details on his condition. His clinical assessment was laced with anger. Why in the hell did that shooter put a second bullet into him? Brent had the situation under control. 10 feet from the victim, and body armor, more importantly, the ability to duck. The explanation was obvious. The entire agency wanted these men dead. He should have seen it coming. The ambulance is on the way, Wilkes cut in with an update. He's not gonna last. Brent heard footsteps behind him as a team assembled near the van and secured the scene in a 30-meter arc. He glared into Feely's eyes. Where were you taking her? Where is your home base? Feely shook off the latest question as he did every other one that he'd been asked while Brent was working on him. He smiled. Something just beneath the surface of his expression screamed to break through. Like a buried confession that desperately wanted to be brought to the light of day, his clenched teeth, stained pale red, kept everything in. Legacy entered the radio chatter, and it immediately went silent. Agent Brent, from your descriptions, I see a high side of 5 minutes. Do exactly as I say. Don't let him see your face and whisper in his ear. We're on our way home. Keep the microphone close. I need to hear. Legacy could hear the rustle of Brent getting into position. He thought about how awkward the intimate distance would appear to onlookers. The response came quickly. We can clean the blood off the seats before we get back, right? He won't know any better. Legacy fed the questions into Brent's ear. How do we get out of here? I can't find the freeway. I-70, you always get lost. I'll drive. He raised up a hand to push himself into a sitting position. Feely had no strength left and fell back, face to face with the agent. You fuck. You fucking cop. I'm dead. Convulsions gripped his body, and he spat blood in a spray that covered Brent's face and slipped invisibly into his neat hairline. Fuck. Brent knocked the earpiece out of position, wiping his face clean. It was over. Feely knew he was dying. Sir? An agent's voice came over his shoulder. Agent Legacy is asking for you. Legacy never asked. Brent had come to know Legacy. It was probably the worst misuse of the word asking since the Huns had requested entrance into Warsaw. He replaced the earpiece. It was like coming midway into the current stream of orders. Repeat, please. Legacy's voice carried an almost electric current of urgency. He's not done. Tell him his boss is dead. But if he knows he's dead, he's afraid of Blue. He won't say anything or think anything unless his death is certain. Remove that from the equation. Just say he's dead. Brent stood over him. Your boss is dead. An angelic look crossed Feely's face. His features softened. Oh, that's terrible. Where is your base? I'll take you there. His body convulsed in a coughing spasm, then his eyes fixed. Brent thought he was dead until he heard the voice sputter one more time. He was such a sweet man. Brent's voice had the finality of a customer service representative explaining a list of fees to an irate customer. He's gone. No ID on them. But if the looks of it, we have yellow and green. Wilkes' voice burst in. I thought we already had positive identification on both of them in Wyoming. Brent answered. Legacy was right. The words must have stung because Wilkes didn't say anything, even though he hadn't read the brief that was eventually printed in the final report with very few changes. This is what the report had to say. The bodies in Wyoming represent a distraction and an odd glimpse at the man who leads this group. He is patient beyond belief. Blade constructed and recreated his family unit around himself. He carefully selected the members of his gang and assembled them as near-perfect body-type matches to his brothers who tormented him through his childhood. The fact that he was followed, even idolized by their likenesses, must have been very satisfying to his ego. It kept the monster fed. The brothers that held him down and spit into his mouth were now kept rigidly in line, cowed by Blade's violence, which lashed out at them. They probably never knew that he was striking out at his past as much as he was striking out at them. It is my opinion, which is as good as fact, that he always expected to use that resemblance as a final distraction. He thought that when his real family died, a mistake would be made on every level of the investigation, and all hell would break loose. He did not know that I would see through it as a plot. Killing the family was always his escape plan. The complexity of torture that led to the death of each of the occupants of the Wyoming house presents itself as proof that this was no mere vengeance killing by a gang of bikers. It was him buying a few days of confusion in the aftermath of his final crime. If there is any comfort to be taken in carnage, it is the fact that something had made him alter the timing of his plan. He was forced to play his cards early. They were dead, and he wasn't finished. All of the kidnappers are still alive and working towards their next goal, with the only change being that most of the FBI is no longer focused on their next objective, too.